Welcome to Spider on the Web, number 20. This week we return to some of what I do best, science fiction. But before we do, a few words on the subject of this podcast itself. I found that I really enjoyed doing this for you, a lot, and I would like to continue. But let me be candid. Given the current state of science fiction publishing, I began this podcast with the specific dream of creating an alternate source of income, because I need one. I've been at it a few months now, brought you 20 of these bad boys, and I've taken in total on the order of $100. That's not even half of what it has cost me just in terms of bandwidth, valuing my time at zero. I'm operating at a loss. That ain't gonna work. If you've enjoyed these podcasts, please kick a few bucks into the PayPal hat at my website, www.spiderrobinson.com. I'm even going to be throwing in some incentives, and we'll talk about them later. And tell all your friends, especially the ones with money. Otherwise, in another few months, I'll have to bag this and go find some way to write books twice as fast and just as good. I got a mortgage to pay. Thanks in advance for your kindness. And now, to start, an excerpt from the first novel in the Lifehouse Trilogy, just now available in a hardcover omnibus for the first time, from Bain Books, with a splendid Stephen Hickman cover. This is Chapter 2 of Mind Killer. 2011. I smelled her before I saw her. Even so, the first sight was shocking. She was sitting in a tan, plastic-serviced armchair, the kind where the front comes up as the back goes down. It was back as far as it would go. It was placed beside the large living room window, which was transparent. A plastic block table next to it held a clock, a dozen unopened packages of self-lighting Peter Jackson cigarettes, an empty ashtray, a full vial of cocaine, and a lamp with a bulb of at least 150 watts. It illuminated her with brutal clarity. She was naked. Her skin was the color of vanilla pudding. Her hair was in rats, her nails unpainted and untended, some overlong and some broken. There was dust on her. She sat in a ghastly sludge of feces and urine. Dried vomit was caked on her chin and between her breasts and down her ribs to the chair. These were only part of what I had smelled. The predominant odor was of fresh-baked bread. It is the smell of a person who is starving to death. The combined effluvia had prepared me to find a senior citizen paralyzed by a stroke or some such crisis. I judged her to be about 25 years old. I moved to where she could see me, and she did not see me. That was probably just as well, because I had just seen the two most horrible things. The first was the smile. They say that when the bomb went off at Hiroshima, some people's shadows were baked onto walls by it. I think that smile got baked on the surface of my brain in much the same way. I don't want to talk about that smile. The second horrible thing was the one that explained all the rest. From where I now stood, I could see a triple socket in the wall beneath the window. Into it were plugged the lamp, the clock, and her. I knew about wireheading, of course. I had lost a couple of acquaintances and one friend to the juice. But I had never seen a wirehead. It is by definition a solitary vice, and all the public usually gets to see is a sheeted figure being carried out to the wagon. The transformer lay on the floor beside the chair where it had been dropped. The switch was on, and the timer had been jiggered so that, instead of providing 1, 5, or 10, or 15 second jolt per hour, it allowed continuous flow. That timer is required by law on all juice rigs sold, and you need special tools to defeat it. Say, a nail file. The input cord was long and fell in crazy coils from the wall socket. The output cord disappeared beneath the chair, but I knew where it ended. It ended in the tangled snarl of her hair at the crown of her head, in a mini-plug. The plug was snapped into a jack surgically implanted in her skull, and from the jack, tiny wires snaked their way through the wet jelly to the hypothalamus, to the specific place in the medial forebrain bundle, where the major pleasure center of her brain was located. She had sat there in total transcendent ecstasy for at least 5 days. I moved, finally. I moved closer, which surprised me. She saw me now, and impossibly the smile became a bit wider. I was marvelous. I was captivating. I was her perfect lover. I could not look at the smile. A small plastic tube ran from one corner of the smile, and my eyes followed it gratefully. It was held in place by small bits of surgical tape at her jaw, neck, and shoulder, and from there it ran in a lazy curve to the big 50-liter water cooler bottle on the floor. She had plainly meant her suicide to last. She had arranged to die of hunger rather than thirst, which would have been quicker. She could take a drink when she happened to think of it, and if she forgot, well, what the hell? My intention must have shown on my face, and I think she even understood it. The smile began to fade. That decided me. I moved before she could force her neglected body to react, whipped the plug out of the wall, and stepped back warily. Her body did not go rigid as if galvanized. It had already been so for many days. What it did was the exact opposite, and the effect was just as striking. She seemed to shrink. Her eyes slammed shut. She slumped. Well, I thought, it'll be a long day and a night before she can move a voluntary muscle again, and then she hit me before I knew she had left the chair, breaking my nose with the heel of one fist and bouncing the other off the side of my head. We cannoned off each other, and I managed to keep my feet. She whirled and grabbed the lamp. Its cord was stapled to the floor and would not yield, so she set her feet and yanked, and it snapped off clean at the base. In near total darkness, she raised the lamp on high and came at me, and I lunged inside the arc of her swing and punched her in the solar plexus. She said, "Guff," and went down. I staggered to a couch and sat down and felt my nose and fainted. I don't think I was out very long. The blood tasted fresh. I woke with a sense of terrible urgency. It took me a while to work out why. When someone has been simultaneously starved and unceasingly stimulated for days on end, it is not the best idea in the world to depress their respiratory center. I lurched to my feet. It was not completely dark. There was a moon somewhere out there. She lay on her back, arms at her sides, perfectly relaxed. Her ribs rose and fell in great slow swells. A pulse showed strongly at her throat. As I knelt beside her, she began to snore, deeply and rhythmically. I had time for second thoughts now. It seemed incredible that my impulsive action had not killed her. Perhaps that had been my subconscious intent. 5 days of wire-heading alone should have killed her, never mind sudden cold turkey. I probed in the tangle of hair, found the empty jack. The hair around it was dry. If she hadn't torn the skin in yanking herself loose, it was unlikely that she had sustained any more serious damage within. I continued probing, found no soft places on the skull. Her forehead felt cool and sticky to my hand. The fecal smell was overpowering the baking bread now. There was no pain in my nose yet, but it felt immense and pulsing. I did not want to touch it or to think about it. My shirt was soaked with blood. I wiped my face with it and tossed it into a corner. It took everything I had to lift her. She was unreasonably heavy, and I say that having carried drunks and corpses. There was a hall off the living room, and all halls lead to a bathroom. I headed that way in a clumsy, staggering trot, and just as I reached the deeper darkness with my pulse at its maximum, my nose woke up and began screaming. I nearly dropped her then and clapped my hands to my face. This temptation was overwhelming. Instead, I whimpered like a dog and kept going. Childhood feeling, runny nose you can't wipe. At each door I came to, I teetered on one leg and kicked it open, and the third one gave the right small room acoustic tile echo. The light switch was where they almost always are. I rubbed it on with my shoulder, and the room flooded with light. Large aquamarine tub, styrofoam recliner pillow at the head end, non-slip bottom. Aquamarine sink with ornate handles, cluttered with toiletries and cigarette butts and broken shards of mirror from the medicine cabinet above. Aquamarine commode, lid up and seat down. Brown throw rug, expensive. Scale shoved back into a corner, covered with dust in which two footprints showed. I made a massive effort and managed to set her reasonably gently in the tub. I rinsed my face and hands of blood at the sink, ignoring the broken glass, and stuffed the bleeding nostril with toilet paper. I adjusted her head, fixed the chin strap. I held both feet away from the faucet until I had the water adjusted, then left with one hand on my nose and the other beating against my hip in search of her liquor. There was plenty to choose from. I found some Metaxa in the kitchen. I took great care not to bring it near my nose, sneaking it up on my mouth from below. It tasted like burning lighter fluid and made sweat spring out on my forehead. I found a roll of paper towels, and on my way back to the bathroom I used a great wad of them to swab most of the sludge off the chair and rug. There was a growing pool of water siphoning from the plastic tube, and I stopped that. When I got back to the bathroom, the water was lapping over her bloated belly, and horrible tendrils were weaving up from beneath her. It took 3 rinses before I was satisfied with the body. I found a hose and spray under the sink that mated with the tub's faucet, and that made the hair easy. I had to dry her there in the tub. There was only 1 towel left, none too clean. I found a first aid spray that incorporated a good topical anesthetic, and put it on the sores on her back and butt. I had located her bedroom on the way to the Metaxa. Wet hair slapped my arm as I carried her there. She seemed even heavier, as though she had become waterlogged. I eased the door shut behind me and tried the light switch trick again, and it wasn't there. I moved forward into a footlocker and lost her and went down amid multiple crashes, putting all my attention into guarding my nose. She made no sound at all, not even a grunt. The light switch turned out to be a pull chain over the bed. She was on her side, still breathing slow and deep. I wanted to punt her up onto the bed. My nose was a blossom of pain. I nearly couldn't lift her the third time. I was moaning with frustration by the time I had her on her left side on the king-size mattress. It was a big brass 4-poster bed and with satin sheets and pillowcases all dirty. The blankets were shoved to the bottom. I checked her skull and pulse again, peeled up each eyelid, and found uniform pupils. Her forehead and cheeks still felt cool, so I covered her. Then I kicked the footlocker clear into the corner, turned out the light, and left her snoring like a chainsaw. Her vital papers and documents were in her study, locked in a strong box on the closet shelf. It was an expensive box, quite sturdy, and proof against anything short of nuclear explosion. It had a combination lock with all of 27 possible combinations. It was stuffed with papers. I laid her life out on her desk like a losing hand of solitaire, and studied it with a growing frustration. Her name was Karen Schultz, but she used the name Karen Shaw, which I thought phony. She was 22, divorced her parents at 14, uncontested, no fault. Since then she had been, at various times, waitress, secretary to a lamp salesman, painter, freelance typist, motorcycle mechanic, and unlicensed masseuse. The most recent paycheck stub was from The Hard Core, a massage parlor with a cut-rate reputation. It was dated almost a year ago. Her bank balance, combined with paraphernalia I had found in the closet, to tell me that she was currently employed as a tootlegger, a cocaine dealer. The richness of the apartment and furnishings told me that she was a foolish one. Even if the narcs missed her, very shortly the IRS was going to come down on her like a ton of bricks. Perhaps subconsciously she had not expected to be around. Nothing there. I kept digging. She had attended community college for 1 semester as an art major and dropped out, failing. She had defaulted on a lease 3 years ago. She had wrecked a car once and had been shafted by her insurance company. Trivia. Only 1 major trauma in recent years. A year and a half ago, she had contracted out as host mother to a couple named Lombard Smythe. It was a pretty good fee. She had good hips and the right rare blood type. But 6 months into the pregnancy, they had caught her using tobacco and canceled the contract. She fought, but they had photographs. And better lawyers, naturally. She had to repay the advance and pay for the abortion, of course, and she got socked for court costs besides. It didn't make sense. To show clean lungs at the physical, she had to have been off cigarettes for at least 3 to 6 months. Why backslide with so much at stake? Like the minor traumas, it felt more like an effect than a cause. Self-destructive behavior. I kept looking. Near the bottom, I found something that looked promising. Both her parents had been killed in a car smash when she was 18. Their obituary was paper-clipped to her father's will. That will was one of the most extraordinary documents I have ever read. I could understand an angry father cutting off his only child without a dime, but what he had done was worse. He had left all his money to the church, and to her, quote, $100 the going rate, unquote. Damn it, that didn't work either. So their suicides don't wait 4 years, and they don't use such a garish method either. It devalues the tragedy. I decided it had to be either a very big and dangerous coke deal gone bad, or a very reptilian lover. No, not a coke deal. They would never have left her in her own apartment to die the way she wanted to. It could not be murder. Even the most unscrupulous wire surgeon needs an awake, consenting subject to place the wire correctly. A lover, then. I was relieved, pleased with my sagacity, and irritated as hell. I didn't know why. I chalked it up to my nose. It felt as though a large shark with rubber teeth was rhythmically biting it as hard as he could. I shoveled the papers back into the box, locked and replaced it, and went into the bathroom. Her medicine cabinet would have impressed a pharmacist. She had lots of allergies. It took me 5 minutes to find aspirin. I took 4. I picked the largest shard of mirror out of the sink, propped it on the toilet tank, and sat down backward on the seat. My nose was visibly displaced to the right, and the swelling was just hitting its stride. I removed the toilet tissue plug from my nostril, and it resumed bleeding. There was a box of Kleenex on the floor. I ripped it apart, took out all the tissues, and stuffed them into my mouth. Then I grabbed my nose with my right hand and tugged out to the left, simultaneously flushing the toilet with my left hand. The flushing coincided with the scream, and my front teeth met through the Kleenex. When I could see again, the nose looked straight, and my breathing was unimpaired. When the bleeding stopped again, I gingerly washed my face and hands and left. A moment later, I returned. Something had caught my eye. It was the glass and toothbrush holder. There was only one toothbrush in it. I looked through the medicine chest again, and noticed this time that there was no shaving cream, no razor, no masculine toiletries of any kind. All the prescriptions were in her name. I went thoughtfully to the kitchen, mixed myself a Preacher's Downfall by moonlight, and took it to her bedroom. The bedside clock said 5. I lit a match, moved the footlocker in front of an armchair, sat down, and put my feet up. I sipped my drink and listened to her snore and watched her breathe in the feeble light of the clock. I decided to run through all the possibilities, and as I was formulating the first one, daylight smacked me hard in the nose.
I would really like to keep reading to you because it's just getting to a good part, but I got 2 other novels to cover this podcast and time is short, so I'm going to move on. After a brief musical excerpt by an amazing musician from India named Vishwa Mohan Bhatt. The George Harrison Memorial DVD, A Concert for George, opens with a piece by Ravi Shankar called Arpan, performed by maybe 50 Indian musicians and a couple dozen Western musicians. And one of them just leaped off the screen at me, Pandit Vishwa Mohan Bhatt, partly because in the midst of his fellow Indians, he was playing brilliantly on what I took to be a slide guitar, played on his lap, Jeff Healy style. I was mistaken. It was his own amazing invention, the Mohan Veena, a 19-stringed instrument based on a slide guitar. I was also partly struck because his face held a magic indescribable quality, also possessed by people like bass player Lee Sklar, guitarist Oscar Castroniv, and Richie Havens, a face that just tells you with absolute certainty, this is a very good man. This may possibly help explain why, according to legend, when Vishwa and Rai Cooter met, they did not bother with rehearsal. They just looked into each other's eyes, smiled, and opened their instrument cases, and spent the next couple of hours winning a Grammy together for their extraordinary CD, Meeting by the River. Vishwa Mohan Bhatt has since collaborated successfully on lovely CDs with Bela Fleck and Jerry Douglas and Taj Mahal, and most recently, and in my opinion, most fruitfully, with my good friend Doug Cox of Comox, British Columbia. Doug operates the annual Vancouver Island Music Festival, which I have described on my website diary as the best musical festival I have ever attended. I stand by that judgment. The two of them recorded together a wonderful album. Now, when I heard that Doug had recorded with Mohan Bhatt, I told him that they should call the album Mo Doug Doug, Doug Doug Mo Mo. Fortunately, wiser heads prevailed, and it was called Slide to Freedom. I'm going to play you a track from it now that'll give you an idea of just the kind of music that they managed to make together. This is a song by Doug that I've heard several other versions of called Beware of the Man Who Calls You Bro. It's about the kind of cat who's got no tail, if you know what I'm talking about. Without further ado, Beware of the Man Who Calls You Bro by Doug Cox, with Vishwa Mohan Bhatt on the Mohan Veena, and his equally brilliant son Salil on his own invention, the Sattvic Veena.
Walk the talk, he's gotta speak his mind. under a picture. He's a smokescreen master full of lies and deception. On the stage, in his eye, he can shed a tear, as long as it helps him with his career. That's one kind of man you think you'd know, but beware of the man who calls you bro. 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 Beware of the man who calls you bro.
Doug plays dobro, slide guitar, lap steel, and resophonic guitar. He has recorded with nearly everyone in Canadian music and is, along with Holger Peterson of Stony Plain Records, one of the most universally loved men in the business. He will be touring Slide to Freedom with both Vishwa and Salil Bhatt from April on. Check his site, www.dougcox.org, for details. Meanwhile, at press time, the album has been shortlisted for a Grammy nomination in the Trad Folk Americana category. Another album by the three of them is already in the works. And don't miss Doug on his exciting new Fathers and Sons tour, the sons being himself and Steve Dawson, the fathers being famous Canadian musician slash actor Jim Burns, and the legendary Mr. Amos Garrett. Now, an excerpt from Time Pressure, the second novel in the Lifehouse trilogy. As we open, our hero Sam, a hippie hermit living in the woods of Nova Scotia in the mid-70s, finds himself with great reluctance making his way up the North Mountain in a blizzard in search of a glue dispenser called Mucus the Moose. Mucus the Moose is one of my most cherished possessions, one of my only mementos of a very dear dead friend. He, the moose, not the friend, is about 15 centimeters tall and bears a striking physical resemblance to that noblest of all meese, Bullwinkle, save that Mucus is as pot-bellied as the Ashley stove in my living room. He is a pale translucent brown from the tips of his rack down to wherever the plimsoll line happens to be, and pale translucent green thereafter. Picture Bullwinkle gone to fat and extremely seasick. His full name and station, Mucus Moose the Mucilage Machine, are spelled out in raised letters on his round little tummy. If you squeeze him gently right there, green glue comes out of his nostrils. If you don't understand why I love him so dearly, just let it go. Chalk it up to eccentricity or cabin fever. Congenital insanity, I won't argue. But he was irreplaceable and special to me, and he was nowhere to be found. I thought of Frank on my way up the trail, and a strange admixture of joy and sadness followed me. Frank was the piano player slash artist who had given me Mucus back in freshman year. Fragile little guy with black curls flying in all directions and a tongue of Sheffield steel. He only smiled in the presence of friends, and his smile always began and ended with just the lips. The way our college worked it, there was a no-classes study week before the barrage of finals week. Frank and I were both in serious academic jeopardy, make-or-break time. We stayed awake together for the entire 2 weeks studying. No high I've had before or since comes close to the heady combination of total fatigue and mortal terror. At one point in there, I've forgotten which night, we despaired completely and went off campus to get drunk. We could not seem to manage it, no matter how much alcohol we drank. After 5 or 6 hours, we gave up and went back to studying. Over the next few days, we transcended ourselves, reached an exhilarated plane on which we seemed to comprehend not only the individual subjects, but all of them together in synthesis. As Lord Buckley would say, we dug infinity. By the vagaries of mass scheduling, we both had all our exams on Thursday and Friday, 3 a day. We felt this was good luck. Maximum time to study, then one brutal final effort, and it was all over. 1 or 2 exams a day would have been Chinese water torture. As the sun came up on Thursday morning, I was a broken man, utterly whipped. Frank flailed at me with his hands, and then with that deadly tongue. Frank only used that on assholes, the kind of people who mocked you for wearing long hair, without reaching me. He and the rest of the world could go take exams. I was going to die. Here. Now. He left the room. In a few moments, I heard him come back in. I kept my eyes shut, determined to ignore whatever he said, but he didn't say anything at all, so with an immense irritated effort, I forced them open, and he was holding out Mucus Moose, the mucilage machine. He knew I coveted the moose. It was one of his most cherished belongings. "I want you to have him, Sam," he said. "I've got a feeling if anything can hold you together now, it's Mucus." I exploded laughing. That set him off, and we roared until the tears came. We were in that kind of shape. The laugh was like those pads they clap to the chests of fading cardiac patients. It shocked me reluctantly back to life. Luck was with me. Mucus was just where I'd hoped to find him, half buried in a heap of dead leaves beside the stone fireplace where I had for a time today lain back and stared through the treetops at the sky. I didn't have to do any digging. The flashlight picked him out almost at once. He was facing me. His features were obscured by snow, but I knew that his expression would be sleepy, lidded contentment, the Buddha after a heavy meal. "Hey, pal," I said softly, puffing just a little. "I'm sorry." He said nothing. "Hey, look, I came back for you." I worked my nose to crack the ice in my nostrils. At this point, the only thing that could hold me together is Mucus. I giggled, and my lower eyelids began to burn. If I felt so goddamn good, why did I suddenly want to burst out crying? Did I want to burst out crying? I wanted to do something. Wanted it badly. But I didn't know what. I picked up the silly little moose, wiped him clean of snow, probed at the hard little green ball in his guts, and poked at his nostrils to clear them. "Forgive me?" But there was only the sound of wind sawing at the trees. No. There was more. A faint, distant sound. Omnidirectional, approaching slowly from all sides at once, and from overhead, and from beneath my feet, like a contracting globe with me at the center. No, slightly off-center. A high, soft sighing with an odd, metallic edge like some kind of electronically processed sound. Trees began to stir and creak all around me. The wind, I thought, and realized that the wind was gone. The snow was gone. The air was perfectly still. When I first moved to Nova Scotia, they told me, if you don't like the weather, sit down and have a beer. Likely the weather you was looking for will be along before you can finish. No climatic contortion, no matter how unreasonable, can surprise me anymore. This was the first snowstorm I'd ever known to have an eye like a hurricane. Fine. But what was disturbing the trees? They were trembling. I could see it with the flashlight. They vibrated like plucked strings, and part of the sound I was hearing was the chord they made. Occasionally, one would emit a sharp cracking sound as rhythmic accompaniment to the chorus. Well, of course they're making cracking sounds, said the rational part of my mind. It's a good 10 degrees warmer. Not 10 degrees warmer? A thrill of terror ran up my spine. I'd always thought that was just an expression, but it wasn't. But was it terror or exhilaration? The cinnamony smell was very strong now, and the trees were humming like the Sunrise Hill Gang chanting Om, a vast world-sized sphere of sound contracted from all sides at once with increasing speed and power. And yes, I was a little off-center. It was going to converge right over there. Pow! A globe of soft blue light did actually appear in the epicenter, like a giant robin's egg, about 50 meters east of me and 2 or 3 meters off the ground. A yellow birch, which had stood in that spot for at least 30 years, despite anything wind or water could do, obligingly disintegrated to make room for the globe. I mean, no stump or flinders, the whole tree turned in an instant into an equivalent mass of sawdust and collapsed. The humming sound reached a crescendo, a crazy chord full of anguish and hope. The globe of light was a softly glowing blue, actinic white around the edges, and otherwise featureless. It threw out about as much light as a 60-watt bulb. The sawdust that fell on it vanished, and the instant the last grain had vanished, the globe disappeared. Silence. Total, utter stillness, such as is never heard in a forest in any weather. Complete, starless, Stygian darkness. It might have taken me a full second to bring the flashlight to bear. Where the globe had been, suspended in the air in a half-crouch, was a naked, bald woman hugging herself. She did not respond to the light. She moved slightly, aimlessly, like someone floating in a transparent fluid, her eyes empty, her features slack. Suddenly, she fell out of the light, dropped a meter and a half to the forest floor, and landed limply on the heap of fresh sawdust. She made a small sound as she hit, a little animal grunt of dismay that chopped off. I stood absolutely still for 10 long seconds. The moment she hit the earth, the stillness ended, and all the natural sounds of the night returned, the wind and the snow and the trees sighing at the memory of the effort they had just made, and a distant owl and the sound of the bay lapping at the shore. I held the flashlight on her inert form. A short, dark, slender, bald woman. No, hairless from head to toe. Not entirely naked, after all. She wore a gold headband, thin and intricately worked, that rode so high on her skull I wondered why it didn't fall off. Eurasian-looking features, but her hips were Caucasian-wide, and she was dark enough to be a quadroon. Smiling joyously at the moonless sky, sprawled on her back. Magnificent tits. Aimlessly rolling eyes, and the blank look of a congenital idiot. Arms outflung, in an instinctive attempt to break her fall, but relaxed now. Long, slender hands. Well, I had wanted an evening's entertainment. That was an excerpt from Chapter 1 of Time Pressure, the second novel in the Lifehouse Trilogy, available right now from Bain Books in better bookstores everywhere, and even some of the mediocre ones. Now a quick musical excerpt, again from Doug Cox, this time with one of the fathers in the Fathers and Sons tour coming up, I mentioned. This is Doug and Amos Garrett from an album they did together some years back, this title track. It's a wonderful song, originally made gloriously immortal by Louis Armstrong and God's goofball Louis Jordan. Here are Doug Cox and Amos Garrett with Life is So Peculiar.
Vabbity-voop-de-vop-de-zed. Life is so peculiar.
You get so wet in the rain
in British Columbia. You get so warm in the sunshine.
Oh yeah, you got that Alberta tan.
It doesn't pay to complain.
I'm not grumbling. When I get up each morning, there's nothing to breathe but air.
Yeah. When I look in the mirror, there's nothing to comb but hair.
You're lucky. When I sit down to breakfast, there's nothing to eat but food. Life is so peculiar, but you can't stay home and brood. Whoa, life.
Tell me about it, Amos.
It's so peculiar. The desert's only got sand.
And that's grand.
The ocean's only got water.
Yeah, you can't drink it all up.
You never know where you stand.
When I go out to dinner, there's nothing to wear but clothes.
When
Whenever I get sleepy, there's nothing to do but doze.
Oh, yes.
Whenever I get thirsty, well, Amos, you know that I like to drink.
I heard that.
Life is so peculiar that it makes you stop and think. Yes, life, father, do everyone.
It's so peculiar.
It sure is.
A fork belongs with a knife.
It sure does. Corned beef is lost without cabbage.
I love cabbage. A husband should have a wife.
Yes, life is so peculiar, but as everybody says, that's life. There's always that guitar. So peculiar.
Sure is.
A bird can usually sing.
Not around me.
Carnivore. A pearl is made by an oyster.
New Orleans.
Rampart Street. You can't be sure of things.
When I get tired of resting, there's nothing to do but walk.
Walking, walking.
When I don't care to listen, there's nothing to do but talk.
Keep your big mouth shut.
When I'm up in an airplane, there's nothing to do but fly.
Mm-hmm.
Life is so peculiar, but I often wonder why. Whoa, life,
father, do everyone.
It's so peculiar.
Sure is.
A fork belongs with a knife.
Definitely.
Yes.
Corned beef is lost without cabbage.
You lost the cabbage. A husband should have a wife.
Yes, life is so peculiar, but as everybody says, that's life.
One more, Ron.
That's life.
How about you, mate?
That's life.
Hand it over, Phil.
That's life.
And there's no arguing with that. For more information about the legendary Amos Garrett, visit www.melmusic.com, that's melmusic.com/Amos_Garrett, GARRETT/. Take that again, that's http://melmusic.com/Amos_Garrett/. For information about Doug Cox, visit DougCox.org. And for information about Vishwa Mohan Bhat, visit www.vishwamohanbhat.com. That's VishwaMohanBhat.com. Now, an excerpt from the third novel in the Lifehouse trilogy, Lifehouse. This is a chunk from the middle where we have a flashback scene explaining how two of our protagonists came to meet and form their unique partnership. Chapter 5, Cute Meat. Memory Shard, June Bellamy, 8 July 1993. June tried to walk as if the right shoe still had a high heel and scanned both sides of the deserted street, searching the shadowed places for danger and the arc-lit places for a door out of the world. At age 28, she had just made what she intended to be her last professional mistake, overestimating not the character but the intelligence of her partner. The slider was so innately lazy, she had assumed he realized what a valuable asset she was to him. She had trusted him completely to handle the blow-off. It was well within his talents. Instead, he had simply skipped, left her standing there to take the gaff when the mark tipped. Caught flat-footed, she had been lucky to get clear with nothing worse than a couple of slaps, one good punch, and a broken high heel. In the slider's stupid estimation, the extra half of the take was compensation enough for the inconvenience of having to find and train another skirt at his next address. Never mind that the new girl would have half June's brain, skills, or talent at best. As a result, June herself was on the street at 4 a.m. in Toronto with no money, no safe address or identity, no local friends, and a dull, nauseating ache on the left side of her face where the fist had caught her. She understood her error and looked forward to explaining his to the slider one day. Some equations, she would tell him, contain certain terms so valuable that they cannot safely be subtracted or replaced. Or perhaps she could match his own laziness and say it even more succinctly. A good place to carve an equals sign occurred to her. But first she had to make sure she was clear, get off the street. The mark might have yelled copper. Or he might be in his Porsche now, casting through the night streets for a redhead with a hitch in her walk. Her hair and makeup would probably pass under streetlights, if she kept the unmarked side of her face to the street. But even the option of playing hooker and flagging down one of the rare motorists was closed to her. She looked like after the rape rather than before. It was so late, other pedestrians were rare, and none she saw looked like a serviceable champion. The cabs had all melted or corralled up or whatever it was they did when you really needed one. That left a rabbit hole, scarce at 4 a.m. in downtown Toronto. Up ahead on this side of the street, a bar with a faint light on inside. Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, it was called. The owner had hubris. Joan was absolutely certain every male who had ever spoken of it had referred to it as horseshit and handjobs. She squinted through the partially frosted window, saw a shadowy figure behind the bar. Thank God, someone as lazy as the slider, still cleaning up at this hour. Her knock startled him. He spun and stared from side to side of the vast window that fronted the street, trying to locate her. He looked young and dumb and just cute enough to believe himself irresistible. Perfect. She knocked again, more weakly than before, and allowed herself to slump. This time he located her, and at once began shaking his head and waving his hands in a reasonably impressive catalog of all the myriad ways there are to pantomime, "Go away, we are closed," a statement so self-evident as to be insulting. Marceau himself could not have returned to serve more powerfully. She managed, long distance in bad light, to convey need, desperation, apology, tremulous hope, and earnest entreaty, without so much as raising her hands or ever drawing undue attention from her sexual desirability. It might not have worked in America, say, but in this blessed country even the bartenders were candy. Knowing he was defeated, but unwilling to acknowledge it yet, he stayed behind the bar and gave her harassed and frustrated. She riposted with abject surrender and saw him fold. She was already digging tissues and another item from her purse as he put down whatever he was fooling with and came around the bar, and by the time he got the door open, the tears she was wiping away looked genuine. He was still doing harassed, but now that he could see her left cheek and general state of disrepair, felt obliged to add concerned and just a touch of generically gallant. Nonetheless, he began by wasting his breath. "I'm sorry, miss, but we're closed." "I know," she said, wasting some of her own, "but I just had a really bad experience, okay? I'm a little shaken up. I thought he was going to... Look, can I just duck inside for a second and clean up? Maybe after that I can figure out what to..." She let her voice trail off. "Look, lady, I'd like to help, okay? But the boss is going to be back any minute. Nashnikot, if he finds out I let anybody in here after closing, he's going to..." He certainly had a lot of breath to waste. "I'll only be a minute, I swear." She paused a moment to let him begin his response, then overrode him with, "Look, I got female troubles. Give me a break, okay?" and took a deep breath of her own to set the hook. He emptied his lungs in a sigh. Breath smelled okay, a good omen, and in the slider's memorable phrase, folded like a full wallet, slowly but thoroughly. "Jesus Christ, you're breaking my stones, lady. All right, look, come on in. The lady's can is over there. Just make it quick, all right?" "You're very kind," she lied, and brushed past him, leaving him to close the door. Once in the toilet, she relaxed and took her time. The cheek wasn't as bad as she had feared. Thank God the son of a bitch wore the diamond on his other hand. She decided it would pass with a little work and did it carefully. Then she addressed the shoes. By wedging the remaining heel under the sink tap, she was able to snap it off, lowering her apparent height by an inch or two. The tear at the collar she managed to repair with a safety pin, although it required taking off the blouse. Since it was off, she took off her bra, too, and treated herself to a full field bath, swabbing the sweat and fear stink from her armpits with paper towels and rolling on fresh deodorant. The bra went into her purse, and several buttons were not rebuttoned when she put the blouse back on. She brushed out her hair and restyled it to present an altered silhouette. She removed and reversed her skirt, changing its color, and rolled its waistband under to shorten it by a couple of inches. She redid her lipstick with care. As an afterthought, she slid a finger down her panties, moistened it, and rubbed it off on each earlobe. She assessed the results in the mirror and felt some of her self-confidence flowing back. "Time to boat this sucker," she thought. She made sure her purse held condoms and left the toilet. He was exactly as she had imagined him, pacing behind the bar, muttering to his feet, drumming his fingers on every flat surface he passed, miming impatience to an empty house. He spun at the sound of her approach and stumbled slightly. When his eyes locked on her, there was an audible click. He had clearly been preparing to resume their dueling mimes with a strong combination of put upon and endangered by your thoughtlessness and in no mood, but the impression collapsed as his targeting computer claimed all available processing power. She waited, let him speak first, and as soon as she did, she overrode him with a husky, "Thank you, kind sir. I really owe you a lot." "You're welcome," he had to say. "But look, I really hope you mean that," she said, "because right now I'd do just about anything for a stiff bourbon." He wanted to say no firmly and at once, but was distracted by the half-grasped changes in her appearance. By the time he refocused, too much time had passed, and it came out ineffective. "Jesus, lady, my boss—" "I'm sure he wouldn't begrudge his lady a single drink," she said. "Not if he knew what I've been through tonight." "Oh, look, a cop glances in and sees you here this time of night, and we got license trouble. Really, they already gave us a couple of warnings. This time they're gonna—" "I'll sit over here out of sight, then," she said, and at once took a seat at a table which was both well outside the cone of light from the single lamp above the register and shielded from the window by a cigarette machine. He glanced down at his shoes and relaxed to the inevitable. "One short one," he said, and turned to hunt for a bourbon bottle. She studied him as he built her drink. He was younger than her, call it 3 calendar, and about a century subjective. He was of pleasing height, shape, and aspect, in shape but not obsessive about it. He was clean-shaven, wearing a black turtleneck and black slacks. He moved with easy grace, light on his feet, but appeared very tired, fumbling for things he needed, and poring with only a sketch of professional elegance. As he went by the register, she noticed the key sticking out of its lock, giving it the absurd air of a wind-up toy. Something indefinable about his upper lip gave her a mild but distinct urge to bite it. When he brought her the drink, she noticed the bulge in his pants without being caught at it. She thought about all these things, and then she made him sit down and told him a long and gaudy and quite fictitious tale about how she had come to need succor at this hour, sipping her bourbon slowly as she created. The story might well have produced an erection on a statue of John Diefenbaker, and when she was sure he had one, she slid a hand into her purse. "I've taken up enough of your time," she said. "Just let me pay for my drink, and I'll let you finish up and go home." She stirred the trash in her purse. "Do you have change for a 20? He blinked at her, turned to look at the locked register, turned back to her. "You don't have anything smaller?" "Afraid not," she said, smiling sweetly. "Oh, forget it. It's on the house." "No, really, it's the least I can do. You want your accounts to balance." "Oh, I already closed out the register. Thanks for offering, but it isn't necessary." "Well, let me give you something for your trouble, then. Really, you've been a lifesaver. Just give me back a 10 and a 5. She began to take out the imaginary 20. This was fun. "I wouldn't dream of it," he said quickly. "Look, if you got some place you can go for the night, that creep could still be back at your apartment." "Oh, I'll think of something," she said. "Well, why don't I go back there with you right now, make sure the coast is clear?" "Didn't you say you have to wait for your boss?" she said sadistically. He blinked twice. "Well, if he's not here by—" he glanced at his watch. "Now, it usually means he's not coming. Really, I'd be glad to lock up here and—" "No, I don't think I'd want to go back to my place just yet. I don't think I'm ready. You wouldn't know of any place else." He went for it like a starving trout. "Look, what's your name?"
"Angela," she said.
"Angela, I know how this must sound, but there's a fold-out couch at my place." He met her eyes squarely. "And I swear you can trust me." She looked him over carefully.
"I almost believe you," she said softly.
"You can," he said. "I've got my share of faults, but I won't ever lie to you."
"I hope you mean that," she said.
"I do," he assured her, quiet sincerity in her voice. She took her time deciding, for the pleasure of watching him mime steadfast, and finally said,
"I don't even know your name. No, don't tell me yet. But I'll go home with you if you'll give me a truthful answer to one question."
"I'm not," he said. "Never even been engaged."
"Well, good, but that wasn't the question."
"What then?"
"How much did you clear?"
He shook his head slightly a few times.
"Beg pardon? How much did you take off the guy tied up and gagged on the floor behind the bar?"
His eyes went to her right hand, still deep in her purse. They were the only part of him that moved. His own hand must have yearned to go to the bulge in his pants she had seen earlier, the one a few inches from his erection, but it didn't even twitch. She was impressed. "You heat?"
"No," she said, "and I'll never lie to you either. Not anymore. Sound like a plan?"
It was his turn to take his time making up his mind.
Yeah, he said finally. I guess it does.
When did you tip? Oh, you were too graceful to be such a lousy bartender. And you left the key in the register.
He was impressed. You're good.
Yes, she said.
Well, I figure I'll probably net somewhere around too large.
Chump, she said fondly. It's time you went professional. Let's book.
Yeah, I'm sick of the place, he agreed. He rose, got a briefcase from behind the bar, said, sorry about that, Cap, toward the floor, and came back to take her arm.
As they walked out the door, they nearly collided with a cop. He glanced at them with idle curiosity, looked away politely, then registered the briefcase and began a double take. Before he could complete it, his jaw collided with a male fist, distracting him so much that he failed to notice June's foot rising like a shuttle launch toward his groin. Its impact folded him like an empty wallet, presenting the nape of his neck to her companion's elbow, and he ceased to be a significant part of their lives.
Now you can tell me your name, she said, when she had made sure the cop was out. I'm Paul Throtmanian. He was breathing audibly, but under control.
I'm Susan Hughes.
Want a gun or a badge? Paul said cheerily.
What would I need with a gun?
Good point. He flexed the fingers of his right hand, winced, and started to walk away. Chump, Susan said, but softly to herself, and got the cop's wallet and pocket change. She told him her right name after the third orgasm. His third. She had long since lost count.
That was the first meeting of one of the three couples who form the heart of Lifehouse, the third novel in the Lifehouse trilogy. The Lifehouse trilogy was my attempt to answer the question, why should a rational man be a good person? What's in it for him? Why should a man act morally or ethically if there is no white-bearded guy with thunderbolts up his sleeve waiting around to enforce things? It took me three books to explain it, and you can now get all three in a single volume from Bain Books, just in time for Christmas. Yay! I'm going to leave you now with another track involving guitar strings, this time from Andrew York, an amazing guitar player who's studied with Lenny Bro, was a former member of the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, and has lately launched off on his own. Andrew customarily plays guitars crafted by David Daly. And this track, however, is from a very special CD that was recorded on Segovia's Personal Axe, a 1931 cedar top built for Andre Segovia by the great Hermann Hauser. The CD is called The Hauser Sessions. The track is called Kinderlight, Josh's Jam. I hope to play you a lot more of Andrew York in weeks to come. Website is www.andrewyork.net. All the tracks in this podcast are copyright material available commercially and are brought to you here with the express permission of the artists.
This podcast, like all of them, is being podcast under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. And if you had a good time this week, I hope you'll drop a few bucks in the collection hat at www.spiderrobinson.com/podcast.html. Thank you very much. See you next week, when we'll get into some major shit disturbing with discussion of a documentary called The Great Global Warming Swindle That's Science Fact. Or is it? The answer, it turns out, is a religious issue.